This is the Sex and Psychology Podcast, and it's the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lay Miller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Believe it or not, doctors have been prescribing antidepressants for nearly three quarters of a century. These drugs were first introduced in the 1950s, but were revolutionized in the 1980s with the clinical introduction of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. These include fluoxetine, which is sold under the brand name Prozac. While these drugs have undoubtedly helped a lot of people, they are notorious for their side effects, especially their sexual side effects. People taking these drugs often report diminished sexual desire, as well as difficulties with arousal and orgasm. It was long thought that these side effects were temporary, and that if you went off the drug, they would resolve. However, a growing number of people are reporting that the sexual side effects have persisted for them despite discontinuing the medication, a phenomenon that has been dubbed post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. This has stoked a lot of concern and controversy in psychiatry and psychology, so that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to discuss what we know about post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, including the symptoms, how common it is, whether there are any gender differences in likelihood of experiencing it, what causes it, and what we can do about it. I am joined by Sue W. Goldstein, an ASEX-certified sexuality educator and the clinical research manager at San Diego Sexual Medicine. Ms. Goldstein co-authored the book, When Sex Isn't Good, to provide education and empowerment to women with sexual dysfunction. She is also managing editor of the journal Sexual Medicine Reviews. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. One of the keys to maintaining a healthy intimate life is having a healthy lifestyle, and that includes being mindful of what you eat. But changing your eating habits can be a challenge. That's why Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals are the perfect solution. They make eating better easy. Their fresh, never-frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. There are over 35 different options each week to choose from, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Plus, there are over 60 nutrition-packed add-ons to keep you fueled and feeling good all day long. Factor is less expensive than takeout. There's no prepping, cooking, or cleaning required. There are options for every meal of the day, and everything is 100% ready to heat and eat wherever you are. It's also flexible to fit your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need each week, and you can pause or reschedule deliveries anytime. I can attest that the meals are fantastic. They're restaurant quality, and they're an amazing solution if you're looking for something fast, premium, and that doesn't require any cooking. What are you waiting for? Get started today and go for your goals. Head to factormeals.com/sexandpsych50 and use code sexandpsych50 to get 50% off. That's code sexandpsych50 at factormeals.com/sexandpsych50 to get 50% off. Have you ever wondered how sex differs around the world? The Sexual Health Alliance can help you to expand your knowledge through their study abroad programs. Join SHA in exploring different cultures, engaging in immersive learning experiences, and collaborating with international experts in the field of sexuality, while also traveling to amazing places and making new friends. Whether you join them for an online conference, enroll in a certification program, or embark on a transformative study abroad adventure, SHA provides a platform to elevate your career. You might even get the chance to study in a foreign country with yours truly. Come meet amazing people, gain valuable insights, and be at the forefront of sexual health education. Visit sexualhealthalliance.com to learn more and secure your spot today. Hi, Sue, and welcome to the Sex and Psychology Podcast.
Thank you so much, Justin. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Thank you so much for joining me. So we're going to be talking about sexual difficulties as they relate to antidepressant use today. So we've been using antidepressants for a very long time, and they've become an extraordinarily popular treatment. The statistics that I've seen suggest that somewhere around 12% of adults in the U.S. today are on antidepressants of some type, with SSRIs being the most common variety. Now, we know that sexual dysfunction is one of the most common side effects of SSRIs. So in general, what are some of the sexual side effects that have been reported by people who are currently on SSRI treatment?
Well, about 70% of people who use SSRIs have a sexual dysfunction. So it could be low desire. It can be arousal issues, which in a male would be erectile dysfunction. In a female, it could be lack of lubrication. It'd be difficult having orgasm. Those are the general categories.
So it sounds like it's quite common in terms of being a side effect to have some type of sexual difficulty, whether it's just not having the desire for sex or having some difficulty becoming aroused or potentially reaching orgasm. And I think that's also part of the reason why I've heard some sex therapists who have prescribed SSRIs actually as a treatment for premature ejaculation, because one of the known side effects of SSRIs is that it can delay orgasm. So that's actually one of the cases where sometimes people might take a drug because they want that side effect. But I think most people who are taking SSRIs don't want the sexual side effects, right?
No, that's totally true. There is actually a premature ejaculation drug approved outside of the United States, which is, you know, a similar chemical because it does slow everything down. But if we're talking about the side effects while on the medication, they are more predominant with SSRIs than SNRIs. But I think the problem in our world is that everyone assumes once you're off the medication, those side effects go away. And that is a fallacy. And I think that's what we really need to talk about.
Yeah. So in recent years, there has been this growing popular media and scientific attention to this topic of sexual difficulties that persist even after people stop taking SSRIs. And this has been dubbed post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, or PSSD for short, because that's kind of a mouthful. I know you've published some research on this. So what does PSSD look like? What kinds of symptoms are we talking about there?
Well, it's the same symptoms that people have while they're on the antidepressant, but they don't go away. And sometimes people actually don't experience those symptoms and they get off the antidepressant hoping that they never have symptoms and the symptoms will start. So the PSSD really refers to symptoms that continue to exist after you're off the SSRI or SNRI. And they're erectile dysfunction, they're low desire, their orgasm difficulty, but they go beyond that. They may have cognitive issues. Today, we're talking about the sexual issues, but it's a biologic change. And, you know, if you want, I can go into some of those changes that we're aware of.
Yeah, I've read a growing number of articles about this. In fact, there was one that was just published the other day. I think it was in The Guardian or The Telegraph. It was in one of the British publications.
The Guardian.
Yeah. The title of it was something along the lines of, it felt like we've been lobotomized, right? Because it seemed to have like this very pervasive cognitive impact and sexual impact at the same time. And I think it's important to highlight here that these are sexual difficulties that are incredibly distressing to the person, right? This is more than just like a temporary or situational thing where they can't become aroused in a moment where they want to be aroused. It's just like across all situations, they just can't get aroused or they can't feel that desire for sex.
And if you talk to psychiatrists who are the people who prescribe these, and I'm not saying that nobody should be prescribed an antidepressant, there are people who need it, but they will say, well, clearly these people had the same problem before they started and they just bring it up. But that's not true. I mean, we've done lengthy research. Our work is mostly in men, but we have many, many women who have the problem as well. And we see the physiologic changes that clearly didn't happen before. A man is aware that he woke up with erections, that he was able to function sexually, and is aware that now he can't. It's clear these are changes, but even the psychological changes, you know, they know what was wrong with them before and what's wrong with them now. What bothers us the most is that when you talked about the number of people who are prescribed SSRIs and SNRIs, is that it's easier to give a prescription for a medication than to do the work. For somebody who has a situational depression, now we're not talking about major depressive disorder. That's a different situation. But for someone who has a situation that bothers them at the time, they could use some therapy and be out the other side and be fine. And instead, it's easier to throw a pill at them. And now you have a young man or a young woman who can't reach orgasm, who can't get an erection, whatever the problem is, based on somebody just finding it easier to prescribe a pill. And that, to me, is what's really wrong with our country. It's no different than many health issues where it's easier to put a pill than to do the work.
Yeah, I think it's such an important point. And I think the blame resides in part on the providers and on the patients, because you have a lot of providers who don't have a lot of time to spend with patients to do the work with them in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy or other things that might help. And so it is faster and easier for them to write a prescription than it is to see patients for extended periods of time. But also you have a lot of patients who come in who just want the pill, who want the quick fix. And this is true for so many different medical conditions. And so it requires a fundamental shift in society in terms of how we view healthcare and getting away from this idea that we just need to take a pill to fix everything, because sometimes pills aren't the answer, or they aren't the best answer for every problem.
And since COVID, every sex therapist has a waiting list. And we know there was an increase in depression during COVID. So that's just made everything worse, especially if you look at the children. We have patients who were put on an antidepressant at 11, 12, 13 years old, and now they're young adults. And they had no say in the matter because they were children and their parents did the best they could. I always say informed consent is the most important thing. And if we can teach our physicians who are prescribing this to be able to share, it's possible, while it is maybe unlikely, but it is possible that, you know, you will get PSSD. It is possible that you will have side effects that will persist. And then maybe those people who don't necessarily need, they don't have major depressive disorder, they have situational issues, maybe then they'll go to a therapist rather than taking the medication. So to me, that's the most important thing, informed consent.
Yeah. And oof, this gets into a whole other issue. If we're talking about adolescents, you know, especially kids around the time of going through puberty, taking a drug like this that might impact later sexual response, can they comprehend like what that might do to their bodies? And how does it affect you in terms of your sexual development if you're taking a drug that blunts sexual response while you're just starting to go through those initial stages of development? I mean, that's a whole separate podcast and conversation. And I don't think we have the research or data to speak to that. But, you know, there's all kinds of important things to think about and explore here. So I wanted to ask, is PSDD, is that a formal medical diagnosis? Is it officially recognized in psychiatry and psychology? What's the status there? Is it accepted or is it controversial? Where do things stand?
PSSD is very controversial. The psychiatric community that supports sexual dysfunction as being biologic and psychologic in general does not accept PSSD as a real diagnosis. It is not in the ICD-10, and I do not believe it will be in the ICD-11, which is now already being used in other parts of the world, but not in the US. The psychologists, I think it may be mixed. Even in the medical community, it's quite mixed. Young men go to a urologist with these complaints because erectile dysfunction is the first thing they may be appearing. And they're young and they're otherwise healthy. And it's hard for most people to understand it's biologic. So let me explain that biology a little, because I think that's important. We look at duplex Doppler ultrasound and grayscale. And what we're looking at is blood flow coming into the penis, blood flow going out of the penis, and the homogeneity, the quality of the erectile tissue in the corpora cavernosa, which are the two erectile bodies in the penis. We see in older men who typically have cardiovascular disease a lot of scarring. The scarring means that the smooth muscle won't relax, which is what it needs to do physiologically in order to trap the blood in and hold an erection. Now, the older population also, because they have cardiovascular disease, have trouble getting enough blood to come in. So they have trouble filling the penis and filling the blood and storing the blood. In these young people with PSSD, we've done the work. They have no problem filling. Their arteries are healthy. They're young men. They do not have cardiovascular disease. But the corpora cavernosa are scarred. And they've done the basic science work in mice to show this. It's actually scarred, which means it cannot have relaxation, which means it cannot store the blood. So that's why they're not able to maintain an erection. You know, it's different than in the older men, but the corpora cavernosa of these 20, 25, 30, 35-year-old men who have been on SSRIs and SNRIs looks the same as our 65, 70-year-old population who are aging males with all the cardiovascular risk factors. And that is what's most distressing. So this isn't in their head, which is what everybody says. Yes, they have psychological problems from this, but this is a biologic phenomenon that we need to understand.
Yeah, and I've seen there have been some groups that have emerged in recent years promoting this idea of PSSD and creating advocacy and awareness around it. And many of them have talked about how they feel dismissed by their providers. And, you know, you mentioned that earlier, some psychiatrists just say, well, this was a pre-existing problem that you had. And I've also heard a lot who say, well, this is just the depression recurring and it's not because of the drugs. And so many people just feel dismissed by that. But what you're saying is that, nope, there seems to be something biological, something that's going on in the body that's happening here. We can't just say this is recurrent depression or that this was a pre-existing issue. There's something more insidious happening here, right?
Yes. We presented this data at the American Neurological Association a couple of years ago, and we're in the process of finishing up a paper to be published. I can't give you a date because I don't know when we're going to finish it, but we never know with papers. That's true. But we have reams of data supporting this, looking at their hormone levels, looking at their blood flow, looking at the corpus cavernosum, looking at their validated instruments, all the questionnaires that they fill out on intake, and comparing that to a population of healthy people the same age and comparing this data to an older population with the same complaints of ED. It's pretty overwhelming and distressing. And, you know, we wish we could put our arms around these people and say, we're going to make you better, but you just have to treat each symptom. So you treat the erectile dysfunction, you treat the orgasm as best you can, you treat the low libido, you just have to go after each symptom because we can't treat the PSSD per se.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about the prevalence of PSSD? So you mentioned earlier that about 70% of people who are on SSRIs will experience some type of sexual dysfunction, and that's usually temporary. But for those who develop this persistent severe dysfunction, even after they discontinue the medication, what do we know at all, or do we know how common that might be?
We really don't know, because I always say this about any problem: until we are able to communicate to the general public that this is a real problem, people don't come forward looking for help until they're so distressed. So we are a specialty clinic and we have a lot of patients with PSSD because we are one of the few places in the world that recognize it and work with patients on it. The story I love to tell is my mom always said, well, you know, she was glad that my husband lived at the time that he did, because when she was growing up, no one had erectile dysfunction. And my husband was the first author on the New England Journal article on sildenafil, Viagra. So he was very, you know, involved in that. And I said to my mother, as many people had ED back then as have now, it's just that until the ads came on the TV and said, oh, we have this treatment for you, people weren't going to the doctor to complain about it. So as long as we don't have communications to the public, that there's such a thing as PSSD and we can try to help you, we're not going to have people coming out of the woodwork. So I don't think we really have any idea how common it is, because as I say, we are a unique clinic and we're seeing this population. We're not seeing a general population of people.
Yeah, we know there's definitely something happening here, but you're right. We don't have a true sense of the scope, in part because it's still a controversial diagnosis, hasn't been fully explored. So there's more that we need to know. But I also wanted to ask about to what extent there might be a gender difference in this or not in terms of whether people are likely to develop it. So you mentioned that you mostly work with men who have experienced this. And in some of the limited data I've seen, it does seem that men are more likely to report issues relating to PSSD than are women. But is that because men are more likely to develop it, or might it be that, and this is something I've said before, I feel like we've unfortunately kind of normalized sexual dysfunction in women to some degree, where when a man experiences a problem with his penis, he's more likely to go and seek care for it because, you know, there's all that value attached to the penis and sexual performance and so forth. But for women and sexual dysfunction, it seems like it's normalized for things to not work as they should, or for you to not become aroused and all these things. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, Justin, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, when we see women who come in with PSSD, they are just as distressed as men. I believe it's going to be just as common, but women don't tend to present with sexual dysfunction. A man will put his penis first. He will put taking care of his penis before buying the Christmas gifts, before going on vacation, because what good is vacation if erections don't work? A woman makes sure that her kids have clothes for school, there's food on the table, they've got the Christmas, it's a vacation. And then if there's money left over, then she takes care of her health. Or if there's time left over, she takes care of her health. And the reality is that because we don't talk about these things, women do just think this is normal. I mean, my pet peeve is menopause. Women think once the vasomotor symptoms are gone that they're post-menopause. Well, post-menopause is menopause, and a woman is in menopause until she's dead. But women don't talk about these things. And if they don't even talk about menopause, why would women talk about post-SSRI sexual dysfunction? Women don't talk about sexual problems in general, young and old women. So I think that it's more a matter that we just don't see this population as often because they don't deal with their sexual health problems as often. But I think we're going to find it's just as prevalent.
Yeah, this reminds me of some of the research I did during COVID, where we looked at prevalence of sexual difficulties during that period in time. And we found that actually a majority of men and women in a representative U.S. sample reported experiencing at least one sexual difficulty, but men were much more likely than women were to seek out medical help for their sexual difficulties. And one of the big stories of COVID that was not reported was that there was actually this huge rise in Viagra prescriptions that happened during that period of time. And I think it was because a lot of these guys were having penile performance issues. They sought healthcare for it, led to a huge rise in Viagra prescriptions. But for women who were experiencing sexual difficulties, they just kind of suffered in silence or figured out a way to do it on their own without seeking outside help.
I think it's more of the suffer in silence. I mean, a man can't perform if he can't get a hard erection. A woman can lie there and just be a receptacle. There may be no pleasure. There may be pain. We have many, many women with pain, not from PSSD necessarily, but women don't need to perform per se. They can just be there, which is awful. Clearly is something, that neither of us believe in. I mean, every individual deserves pleasure from sexual activity. You shouldn't be having duty sex. It should be something that's pleasurable. So these are the lessons we need to teach women, that they are as deserving as men and that there is healthcare out there for them. The problem is it's harder to find that healthcare because I always say to my patients who are frustrated with their gynecologists, when they went to residency, they did two residencies, obstetrics and gynecology. And the only thing they had in common were the reproductive organs, but they're really two different sets of training. They didn't learn about sexual function. Urologists are the ones that started sexual function, research with men, and urologists are the ones who started it with women. And it's only now, the last 20 odd years, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health has been teaching providers all about how to care for women or people with vulvas, not all women, but people with vulvas, how to have healthy sexual lives and help them with their problems. Sorry, that was a shameless plug for ISWISH. I had to put that in.
No, I love it. ISWISH is a fantastic organization. So there's still a lot we don't know about PSSD, and your work has illuminated some of the factors that might help to explain like what the cause or contributing mechanism there. But a big question I think people often have, I think we probably still don't know the answer to it, is can this arise from just taking a single dose of an SSRI? Is it related to how long you're on the medication? You know, I've seen anecdotal reports and, I don't know how much stock to put in things that you read on Reddit or elsewhere, but some people say they just took one dose of an SSRI and they've developed PSSD. Do we know anything about dosage-related effects for this, or does it matter how long you've been on the med?
Actually, we do. There is no dosage relation. We have seen patients who took it for 7 days. We've seen patients who've been on it for 10 years. It doesn't seem to make a difference what the effect. They can still get PSSD. I don't remember if we have anyone who took it only one day, but I know we have someone who took it 7 days and possibly less. I just can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, that's the scariest thing. People who start it and then they read about it after they go home, they took their pill and it's like, wait a minute, I don't want to do this. And that we do see.
You know, the million-dollar question, of course, is there anything we can do about this? Is it possible to resolve PSSD? So in your work with patients, have you found for some people, does it tend to get better or go away with time? Are there any treatments that work? What do we know?
So we do symptomatic treatment and regenerative treatments. I mean, that's essentially how we treat all sexual dysfunctions. So there are central mechanism drugs like ADDI and Vyleesi that work in the brain to change the balance of serotonin and dopamine. So those can help with cognitive issues, and those can also help with orgasm issues. They are actually FDA approved for premenopausal women with low desire. However, there is no hormonal issue with this. It's just a choice that the FDA said. So it works in postmenopausal women and in men as well. So we would prescribe, one or both of those for men with low desire. And then for the erection for men, we would prescribe certainly like a daily low dose Tadalafil Cialis, because that helps with oxygenation. And one of the problems is that the oxygen has basically been cut off, and that's why the muscle scars. So we would do that daily. And then you could use a PDE5, any of the brands, for sexual activity if that is enough. That's a Band-Aid. So that's something that's symptomatic. Or if the erectile dysfunction is more severe, we can do self-injection therapy. Again, that's symptomatic. We do regenerative therapies. We do low-intensity shockwave therapy. And for people listening, you have to be careful because there are a lot of machines out there that are acoustic wave, but they're not shockwave. They will take your money, but they will not help you. And they actually run a chance of harming you. So you want to make sure you're in a legitimate shockwave machine. But that's something you do multiple times. And that actually, essentially, to make it really simplified, it turns on the stem cells in that location. So in the penis and the perineum, the cruse, turns on the stem cells so that they can then start to regenerate healthy tissue. And we have seen, while not becoming perfect, we have seen improvement in erectile tissue such that patients can function by taking, you know, a PDE5 just before sex instead of having to self-inject, or they can use an injection that previously didn't work. So that is really a wonderful therapy. We do platelet-rich plasma, for which we really don't have the data. That's more anecdotal. We say if that's also a regenerative therapy to turn on the stem cells there. And if people find it helpful, we would continue to do that. If they don't find, you know, any of these therapies, if it doesn't help on an individual basis, there's no therapy helps everybody. Most, you know, therapies typically help about 70% of people. And then for women, we would also, we would check their hormones. They also have PDE5s for women for arousal. So there are therapies that we would use for each of the symptoms, versus having the treatment specifically for PSSD. I think that's really the best way to describe it. I mean, maybe someday we'll have something, but it causes too much damage to be able to say, okay, this takes it away. Maybe someday we can invent an antidepressant that doesn't cause the damage.
Yeah. Well, you know, that leads into my next question, which is, you know, something I think a lot of listeners are thinking about right now is whether SSRIs are still worth it if there's that risk of PSSD. So for people who might be concerned about this, you know, what should they know? Are there other antidepressants like bupropion or, you know, drugs that target dopamine instead of serotonin that might be worth considering that don't cause these kinds of side effects? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the problem with some of those that don't cause sexual side effects, are they strong enough? It really depends what's wrong. If you have major depressive disorder, it's very different than if you have situational depression. I think that's a conversation. I'm not a clinician. I'm not a prescriber. So that's really a one-on-one conversation to have with your psychiatrist, if that's who's prescribing it. I think if you're going to an internist, and the internist is prescribing it, that maybe it's time to talk to a psychiatrist to get something, because they're more aware of all of the side effects of every medication. I think that would be my advice. Don't, you know, we see young girls who go, they're on oral contraceptives, which increases the sex hormone binding globulin, which then binds with the free testosterone. And so it lowers the amount of testosterone available, which is basically the drug of desire, among many other things that it does. Then they lower desire, but they also develop depression. And they go to their doctor and they say, okay, I have depression. And he turns around and gives them an antidepressant. I mean, it's extremely common in the young, among young women. And then that changes everything again. So they still have more low desire. So it goes back to the informed consent. We know that oral contraceptives cause all these problems, but we never explain that to young women, which is no different. And then they give them the antidepressant on top of it. We're doubly poisoning them. So it's really a matter of having a conversation. I think, going back to your original question, going to a specialist, if you're talking about an antidepressant versus a generalist, I think that's the most helpful thing someone can do.
Thanks for sharing all of that. So I know you've been at the forefront of treating sexual dysfunction for quite a long time. And I know you also do some current work with a biotech company, Vela Bioscience, that's looking into treatments for various sexual dysfunctions. So is there anything you can share about what you're working on now as it relates to treating sexual difficulties or new advances, things that we can explore in this area?
Well, Vela Bioscience is definitely a new treatment avenue. I think looking at the psychedelics, that's really the newest thing now for orgasm, is looking at that MDMA and mushrooms, but it's yeah. I mean, looking at that whole rank of medications, Vela currently has an over-the-counter arousal gel that I will tell you, I have tried it. As a sexuality educator, I can talk about my experiences. When you're a physician, you're not supposed to talk about your experiences. As an educator, you are. I have tried it and I was blown away. I don't have any sexual difficulties. I have no problem reaching orgasm. But it was, I don't want to say instantaneous because you put it on ahead of time, but it says wait about 15 minutes. And then when we started to have sexual activity, for me, my first orgasm was almost instantaneous. And we are now starting to give that out to our patients to try to see whether it's the PSSD patients or there are many reasons to have problems with orgasm for women. But it feels very miraculous. And we're actually very excited about it because we've tried a lot of things over the years. People give us a lot of free stuff when you go to a meeting. I mean, that's the reality of it. And some of it is just garbage. And some of it you look and say, oh, I don't want to, you know, the stuff that's in this is not safe. And while there is a little bit of propylene glycol in this, so if somebody has an allergy, if somebody is a particularly sensitive, if they have aberrant mast cell conditions, they probably should stay away from this. But for the average person with labia and vulva and clitoris, and they want to have, you know, more excitement, the arousal was phenomenal. And I don't promote treatments from companies. I was blown away. As was my husband. And for those people watching, my husband is one of the most famous people in the field of sexual dysfunction, which is how I got involved in this field.
Yeah. So in terms of sexual dysfunction treatment, I feel like in many ways, we're still kind of just barely scratching the surface. I mean, Masters and Johnson did their pioneering work in the 1960s and 70s and really laid the groundwork for the modern sex therapy movement. But in terms of how biotechnology and other things can help us to advance that, like, we're still very much in our infancy. There's so many things that we're still learning. And I think it's also very promising that, like, there's a lot that we haven't yet uncovered or explored in terms of how to treat some of the most persistent sexual difficulties, like difficulties with orgasm or difficulties with sexual desire, which are often notoriously difficult to treat with something like cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, I will say that ISWISH has published on sexual desire, on HSDD, hyperactive sexual desire disorder, which is the actual name for it. And we talk about the two medications that are currently approved for premenopausal women with acquired low desire. We also talk about testosterone in the peri and postmenopausal women. And we talk about sex therapy. And we put them at equal places because we don't really know. You know, anybody can use any or all of those. Well, they're not mutually exclusive. I did do a study a while ago in women that were prescribed flibanserin, which is the trade name is Addy. And we divided them in half, and one half just had the medication and one half had the medication and sex therapy. And it should be no surprise to you, Justin, that the group that had the medication and the sex therapy had more improvement than the group that just had the medication. So to me, sex therapy is a really important part. It's a really important adjunct. We have a biopsychosocial medical practice. So our patients coming in see our sex therapist as well as the physician, as well as getting testing. Because we believe that, you know, your brain is attached to your body, your mind's attached to your body. And we differentiate between it's all in your head, means psychological, or it's all in your brain, which means, you know, brain chemicals, serotonin, dopamine, and everything. But they're all attached. And if you make a woman or a man, if they have sexual dysfunction, they're going to have psychological issues. They're going to have social issues, particularly with things like PSSD. We see people sleeping on their parents' couch because they can't exist anymore. They can't go to work anymore. They can't deal anymore. There's another problem, post-finasteride syndrome, which is also, those are sort of the two big problems we see that we're still trying to learn about. If you lose your executive function, for some people, it may be difficult to maintain their current employment. And so, or, you know, if you can't function sexually, you're not going to hang out with the guys on Friday night at the bar picking up girls because you can't do anything. And your whole life changes. And that, you know, those are psychosocial issues that are a result of the biologic problem. So we really need to look at people as a whole. They're not just a penis. They're not just a vagina. And I will say vagina because the sexual function, most of the sexual function happens outside the vagina. It's in the vulva, the vestibule, the clitoris. But we're more than just our parts. It's how they all interact.
Yep. I love that. And, you know, I have a textbook on human sexuality and it's written from a biopsychosocial perspective. So we need to be looking at all of those things at the same time. And I appreciate that that's what you're doing in your work. So thank you so much for sharing all of this with us, Sue, about PSSD. And we look forward to more research because there's still a lot of unanswered questions in this area. So thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Sue. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you. I work at San Diego Sexual Medicine. You can go to sdsm.info to find out more about what I do and what we do at our practice. I am a clinical researcher and I am a sexuality educator, and I love talking to people about their sexual health. And, you know, if you want to come to San Diego, I look forward to meeting you. And thank you for having me, Justin.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here and hearing your wisdom. Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.